91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. What is power and what does it mean to be powerful in the 21st century? Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman. Renowned psychologist Dr. Dacher Keltner has spent 25 years studying how people gain, use, and abuse power in an attempt to understand how power works. Does power corrupt? Drawing on the groundbreaking research, he demonstrates how power can be a force of good in the world. Dr. Keltner has written The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. According to his research, power dynamics affect every aspect of our lives, and power is attainable for each of us. We'll also consider the price of powerlessness. Topical Currents coming up next after NPR and regional news. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. Today we consider the phenomenon of power. We examine the latest research on the subject. In the 16th century, Italian diplomat and political theorist Niccolò Machiavelli authored the political treatise The Prince, in which he wrote, "It is far safer to be feared than loved." Author and American psychologist and University of California, Berkeley professor, Dacher Keltner, passionately disagrees. He's been studying how power, and just as importantly, a lack thereof, how it works for over 20 years. Dr. Keltner is also the faculty director of the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center and a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion. He's the author of the best-selling book, Born to be Good, and his latest book is The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dr. Keltner joins us now from Berkeley, California. Welcome, Professor.
Bonnie, it's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. There's so much to cover. So I just thought a good place to begin was with your definition of power and what it means to be powerful in the 21st century.
Well, that's probably the most important place to begin. So, you know, people tend to intuitively think about power as really wealth or military might or political access. But really, when you start to kind of look more broadly at what power is, and you see it in your family life and in your romantic life and at work, I think there's a need to broaden our definition of power. So how a lot of social scientists define power is that it really is this capacity that the individual has to alter the state of another person, be it the economic conditions of the person, the emotional life of the person, the physical life, or their opportunity to participate politically. But power is your capacity to influence others.
Which is not what we're used to hearing or thinking. So you write a lot about The Prince by Machiavelli, which I mentioned, because, of course, it is the seminal book about the nature of power and amorality. First, if you would just talk about the book, perhaps there are those who are unfamiliar with it and the time it was written.
Sure. So, you know, our thinking about power, Bonnie, as you're anticipating, was profoundly shaped by this one book written in the 16th century, I think 1512, by Niccolò Machiavelli. And Machiavelli was a politician in Florence, and he got kicked out of his job, and he was tortured, and he was in this kind of depressive state, and he wanted to get back into Florentine politics. And so he wrote this book for the Medici family called The Prince, and it's this really short book, but it really is a blueprint for 16th century Italy, and that's important to remember, about how to get power. And as you noted in your quote, it's all about coercion, manipulation, ruthlessness, and really, quite frankly, strategic violence, where you take people down to rise in power. And I think, you know, a lot of our Western European thinking about what power is, and when your listeners think about, well, what is power, they kind of touch upon Machiavelli's influence. But in fact, that view of power and that strategy to gain power of manipulation, deception, and aggression doesn't work as well today in our 21st century.
Now, Wouldn't you agree that sometimes Machiavellianism still does work? I mean, if we look at the political, the state of politics, if we look at international affairs, it looks like it's still alive and well in some instances.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, and they're really, to be fair, there are multiple strategies by which we gain influence in the world, right? We can rely on these Machiavellian approaches. We can rely on what social psychology is starting to focus on about how people gain power by lifting up the welfare of others. So certainly Machiavellianism works in certain pockets of economic activity in certain countries, perhaps. Even, you know, I mean, I think it's fair to say, and this wouldn't surprise your listeners, there are certain presidential candidates who are looking pretty Machiavellian when it really boils down to it. But, you know, it's really interesting, Bonnie. We even tested whether Machiavellianism works in U.S. politics. We coded the speeches of U.S. senators in the 1990s for evidence of things like Machiavellian strategies. Do they kind of take people down and laugh at other people's suffering? And then more virtuous strategies, like do they show courage and a sense of humanity or concern for others? And it was really the senators who didn't use these Machiavellian strategies but showed more humanity who got more support for their bills. So we're shifting out of a more Machiavellian philosophy of power to a more collaborative model. And it's gradual, and there'll be places where Machiavellianism still prevails.
As we're seeing. Okay.
Well, we will see, right?
Yes.
Yeah, my hypothesis is, you know, to be honest, Trump's Machiavellianism, his coercion and his fear-mongering, I think it's hurting the Republican Party. So that suggests it's costing that party in terms of power. And I think ultimately it will hurt his candidacy. And we also know, it's important to note, that philosophy of power is costing the United States in terms of our influence on the in the international stage.
Right.
People are looking at us as if something strange is happening.
Mm, right. Okay, let's talk about the skills that you've talked about that we do rely on to achieve positions of power in the 21st century, the social intelligence, empathy, kindness, compassion, taking an interest in the welfare of others. First, how do you define social intelligence?
Yeah, so, you know, the research that you're referring to, Bonnie, is really interesting. It, you know, for the past 30 years, social scientists have been looking at who gains power, right? You can study kids in high school and who rises in terms of the respect of their peers. You can look at who gets power in a finance firm or a workplace, who gets power in a military unit. And they track who gets power and they measure their social strategies early and see whether what kind of social practices get you power in different social networks. And I think the fair summary, what I write about in The Power Paradox, is it's really the socially intelligent individual who gains power, who is aware of other people's interests, who engages in specific behaviors like sharing resources or expressing appreciation or gratitude that that lift up other people's interests, who engages in behaviors that unite people and build strong social networks, right? So social intelligence is knowing what other people are interested in and acting in thoughtful ways that lift up other people's interests. And what the studies find time and time again is it isn't Machiavellianism that prevails in these contexts, work, school, neighborhood, military units. It's really more socially intelligent individuals who lift up the interests of others.
And there's science that bears this out.
Yeah, you know, like a lot of your listeners probably, I had very problematic assumptions about power. And I thought, well, it's always the, you know, nice guys finish last. It's always the Machiavellian who prevails.
Right.
And when I looked at this science, I was really surprised and struck. This is over 70 or 80 studies of where people, scientists are looking at, you know, study kids at the start of the school year, like, for example, in seventh or eighth grade, and then find out who becomes class president or vice president, who is the editor of the newspaper, who has the respect of their peers. Or they'll go into an organization and they'll find out, you know, when you hire someone, which of those individuals who is hired actually rises in the ranks of that organization. And it is this more socially intelligent individual that's aware of other people's interests enacting in ways that benefit people that rises.
But what about...
Surprise me too.
But what about the one doing the hiring?
Well, that's where the problem begins in what led me to the Power Paradox title, which is, you know, we have learned through a lot of different studies we've talked about that, you know, lifting up other people's interests gets you power. But the person doing the hiring who often feels in a position of power over other people, what our studies find time and time again, Bonnie, is when you feel powerful, when you come from a life of privilege, when you feel that you're better than other people, you lose those socially intelligent skills like empathy and kindness and sharing and expressing gratitude that got you power in the first place. And power tends to corrupt.
It's so incredible. I mean, it's so ironic because the very things that got you there are the very things you lose when you get there.
I know.
Which is the power paradox.
It is. And you know, I think most of your listeners have had this experience. And when you study history or when you look at the daily newspaper and you hear about the inappropriate behaviors of politicians and people in power and, you know, people in religious hierarchies and athletes, and you can't help but bump into this tendency in human nature that when we feel powerful, we abandon the socially intelligent practices that earn us the power and respect of other people.
Why, from an evolutionary standpoint, would our empathy and compassion centers in the brain become disengaged when we feel powerful, given how self-destructive that is?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. Obviously, this isn't very adaptive behavior, but I think, Bonnie, you know, you're pinpointing exactly what we've learned in this science. It's really pretty remarkable, which is that when we randomly assign ordinary people like you or me to a position of power in the lab, right? Or you bring someone and you say, hey, you're in charge of other people. Or, you know, imagine a time when you really felt in charge of people and had a sense of power. What happens when you feel powerful is kind of the reward centers of the brain become hyperactive and you're just looking for things to please yourself. As you nicely observe, Bonnie, what scientists are also finding is when you feel powerful, the parts of your frontal lobes that help you empathize with other people, big parts of your brain, really important parts, are literally quiet and disengaged. And then in that mental state, you're more likely to gratify your impulses, to approach people inappropriately in sexual ways, to swear at other people, to hoard resources in this mental state of power. I don't think it's evolutionarily advantageous to kind of gratify all of these impulses in that way. And in fact, very often it leads to people's downfall. It's just a...
Exactly.
Kind of a bare... It's a paradox of the human condition.
We're speaking with Dr. Dacher Keltner. He's an author and a professor of psychology at University of California in Berkeley and the faculty director of both the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center and the Social Interactive Lab. He's written The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman resuming our conversation with Professor Dacher Keltner. He's a psychology professor at UC Berkeley, and he's written The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Well, you've heard some of what we've been talking about already, so I'll just throw it out to our listeners. How do you define power? Do you see yourself as powerful, and what does that mean to you? Are you someone who gives power to the most empathetic and compassionate, or do you find yourself generally in fear of those with power? Your thoughts, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. org. Professor Keltner, I wanted to talk about some of your experiments because they're fascinating.
Sure. Thank you.
Beginning with the ones in the street, the intersection with the four-way stop sign, which I don't know how much you know about South Florida drivers, but they're pretty notorious for going red lights and through stop signs and stuff. And your findings were pretty amazing. So let's begin with that one.
Sure. Thank you. So, you know, one of the things that we've done and what I review in the Power Paradox is just literally dozens, if not hundreds of studies that examine how does power and privilege just shape our most basic behaviors like eating and sharing and how we speak to others. And power tends to produce more self-serving impulsivity. We swear at people, we hoard resources and the like, which should be pretty familiar to many of your listeners. And so Paul Piff and I asked this question, does power influence how you drive? And to be absolutely frank, it began out of a personal experience. I ride my bike to school, and this black Mercedes blazed through this stop sign without really stopping and nearly killed me. And then when we were confronting each other, he looked at me as if I was in the wrong, and I was stunned. So we looked at whether power influences how people drive. And what we did is in California, there are these pedestrian zones that are designated parts of the road with white stripes that really give the right of way, the legal right of way, to pedestrians. And we positioned a poor Berkeley undergraduate right at the edge of the pedestrian zone. He looked at oncoming traffic. We had another Berkeley undergrad code whether the car coming on a 5-point scale was a kind of a poor car, like a Yugo or an AMC Pacer or a Ford Pinto, or all the way up to very wealthy high-power cars, right? The Range Rover and the Mercedes. And you know what we found, Bonnie? It's really quite remarkable. All of the drivers of the poor cars stopped and let the pedestrian cross the street. No one blazed through the pedestrian zone. By contrast, 46.2% of the drivers of the high-powered Range Rovers and Mercedes and the like blazed through the pedestrian zone, ignoring the pedestrian. And that just typifies a lot of different findings showing that power makes people feel entitled. It makes people narcissistic. It makes them feel like they have the right of way over others, even in violation of the law.
Would you say, and I guess this is exactly what you're not saying, but just to be clear, that those with power temperamentally are predisposed to be more calculating or more deceptive or more privileged, to act more privileged? Or is it across the board that power can actually make you that way through what you described before?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both in this, but what's really persuasive about these studies, and then in a lot of the laboratory studies, we randomly assign people to positions of power. And what we are making the case for is that just the feeling of power and feeling better and higher than other people in almost any human being will lead to these impulsive behaviors, these selfish behaviors, and empathy deficits where, you know, the lab studies show once you feel powerful, you aren't as careful at judging other people's emotions. You don't listen as carefully. You don't speak as considerately. So we think, and I think there are a lot of studies in the Power Paradox that back this up, that this is one of the problems of having power, is it disengages you from other people and produces problematic behavior in just about everybody.
It's so fascinating. And we're going to get to ways of how to avoid the trap of the power paradox. But one of the things that it made me smile, I guess, you said that the best rated American presidents were those with empathy and compassion, such as Abraham Lincoln and FDR. And I thought, that's a very short list. Is there anyone else on that list?
Well, you know, JFK makes the list, and then, according to historians, Ronald Reagan has this particular legacy. You know, I would contest it politically, but you know, it really struck me, Bonnie, when I was writing the Power Paradox and summing up all this science about what power is, how we get it, what does it do to us, what happens when we don't have it in our lives. I made sure to go to other kinds of studies of power, and there are a lot of studies by historians that have been summed up recently of what makes for a great legacy as a U.S. president. And what they've come up with is you know, it is the individual who engages and stirs the collective and who engages in the interests of others. You know, Lincoln is right at the top, a spectacular U.S. president. I love this quote of Lincoln, of Thurlow Weed, who studied him really carefully in the 19th century. And he said, you know, Lincoln, that his political genius is that he sees all who come to see him and he hears all who come to speak to him. He was just sort of, as a practice, deeply engaged in everybody's interests with respect.
One of the things you also talk about is that, let's say somebody gets power through the Machiavellian means, that they don't retain their power. Talk about that.
Sure. It's interesting. You know, I've seen this firsthand. I teach leaders here at UC Berkeley, you know, for the past 20 years of government and science and technology and business and education. And people who do practice these Machiavellian approaches to power of, you know, manipulation and deception and pitting people against each other and making sure nobody's forming strong alliances and aggression, sometimes they rise, right? They get a lot of attention, our studies show. Everybody's thinking about them because they're so disruptive, if you will. And sometimes they'll rise to positions of power. But what a lot of the research on that philosophy of power shows is maybe they are charismatic initially or get people to direct attention to them. But over time, groups become savvy to them. They become aware of them. They gossip about Machiavellians. They worry about them. And what the studies show is that Machiavellians, at least, you know, in the United States and many Western European contexts, tend to fall in power. People start to disrespect them. They start to gossip about them. They start to tell other people this person isn't really fit for a position of leadership. And they tend to fall in power and not to enjoy prestige or respect from other people.
We have a caller. Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Let's take a moment to speak to Gail in Boca Raton. Welcome, Gail.
Yes, thank you very much. I think this is a wonderful topic, and I like the description of power as the ability to influence others. However, I have a question with regard to, are some groups more influenceable than others? Is there not some kind of paradigm that has to do with giving power and groups that don't allow themselves to be governed or given up their individual rights? Mm. It just feels as if, cannot a group say no? An educated, well-informed group say no.
Okay, Professor.
That's a terrific question, mm-hmm. Gail. So social psychologists have really been interested in, at the group level, how some people approach power, right? And as Gail is suggesting, there are groups who tend to like more rigid hierarchies, who are more influenceable, who actually are drawn to slightly more coercive types of leaders who sort of lead from the top and direct and issue edicts and the like. And then there are other kinds of groups that are a little bit more interested in, you know, kind of a more dynamic approach to power where there's a negotiation for power and it's distributed in a different way. And it tends to map on to different political ideologies. This research shows that conservatives tend to like more hierarchical distributions of power, liberals a little bit more bi-directional and negotiated. And I think that probably taps into your intuitions.
Do you remember, because I cannot remember, who said, it was either in a play or in written form, silence equals agreement?
I don't know. And if you find that, please send it along because, you know, one of the things that we're learning is that, regrettably, one of the costs of powerlessness when you don't feel respected and engaged mm-hmm. and have a capacity to influence at work or in politics or in your family, you become voiceless. You
yes.
have silence, and it perpetuates problematic abuses of power.
Yeah. That's just wonderful reply, and thank you very, very much. It's a fascinating topic. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you, Gail. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And I guess we have an emailer who asks how this theory explains the rise of Trump, which you really all addressed already, but do you want to just go over that again?
Well, you know, it's been so interesting having published the power paradox just as Trump was rising. And, you know, so here's how I think about it from a social psychological perspective, which is Trump did very early on give voice to a part of our United States citizenry who is very frustrated with economic conditions and social conditions in our country, poor white or European Americans. And he really spoke to their frustration and anger. And that was his most impassioned part, sort of realm of support. But at the same time, you know, when you think about the costs of a more coercive Machiavellian approach to power, of being fear-mongering and manipulative and deceptive and impulsive, I think, you know, what we're seeing, Bonnie, if you look at the Republican Party's struggling to support him, if you look at Mitt Romney very directly mm-hmm. critiquing Trump, if you look at other countries saying, this guy, we wouldn't listen to this guy, we are seeing the how this approach to power actually undermines the power of that individual and the constituency he or she represents as a loss of power.
We're speaking with Professor Dacher Keltner. He's an author, teaches psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's written The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Lots more to talk about on today's Topical Currents. A short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Dr. Dacher Keltner, author, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, and also an expert, a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion. He's written The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. And we'll continue our conversation. Also, our number, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio at WLRN.org. Professor Oren wants to know if you studied power inside the family and between partners, which, of course, you have.
Well, thanks so much for that question. This is, you know, this is what in many ways led me to write The Power Paradox. Bonnie, you know, I had a naive view of power. I thought power was just at work, and I would come home, and then I'd be negotiating in these power struggles with my 4-year-old and 2-year-old daughters, right? Or I'd see their power dynamics as an older sibling or a younger sibling. And I thought about my relationship with my wife, Molly, and suddenly it felt like we were struggling and negotiating much as diplomats would negotiate or people on Wall Street. And that's why I arrived at this definition of power as really your capacity to influence and alter the states of others. And what that tells us, and Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, said that power is the basic medium or context in which we relate to everybody. It is part of every relationship. And once you start from that definition, you realize, wow, there are serious power struggles between romantic partners. And the more that they mutually empower each other, the happier their marriage, the better their sex lives. There are power struggles between parents and children from even when the fetus is developing in the womb, there are power struggles over resources. Those continue for the rest of life. So I hope when readers read The Power Paradox, they'll get insights into using power for the good in their own personal lives. So absolutely.
I wanted to go back to something which is access to more information, the digital age, social
yeah.
networking,
yeah.
influences, how that's changed the power structure. And the dissemination of information, how that changes also the Well, I'm thinking of when you talk about reputation, how that's really a good way of disseminating information. But how do you think that our whole digital age has changed this?
That is such a terrific question, Bonnie. You know, we are in this radical experiment right now, which is, you know, when you think about Facebook and Twitter, you know, and a Twitter presidential candidate, right? And then the distribution of news via Instagram and other sources. We are in an unprecedented age of sharing of information. And on balance, it has, in some sense, empowered and democratized ordinary individuals. So there are recent analyses, for example, of all the turmoil that's happening in the Middle East and other cultures, showing a lot of it has to do with this rapid spread of information in young people, where they suddenly, you know, in countries like Saudi Arabia or Tunisia or Libya, there's young people sharing this information about what it means to have individual rights, which they didn't know about prior to this kind of digitally distributed information. Today, businesses are, as you intimate, are very concerned about Yelp ratings that ordinary citizens provide that dictate the flow of capital. So we're in this new era of democratized commentary and sharing of information that does empower, both for good and for bad.
Right, exactly. Let's talk to Jason in Miami, who has a question for you, Professor. Go ahead, Jason. Welcome.
Hi, Bonnie. Hi, Professor Keltner. Great topic. I work for a prominent art gallery in the Miami area, and our CEO is pretty much everything that you've described so far, and more, frankly.
Which side of what he's described so far?
the bad side.
Okay.
But one thing I've noticed, and I mean, I guess just to give you an idea, I mean, well, one thing I've noticed is that when I first met him 10 years ago, I came to the gallery, and the way he talked to people, talking down to them, screaming at them, go get me this, you know, go get me that, go get me this, and people running all over the place, tripping over themselves to do what he wanted them to do. And the first day I met him, I asserted myself. I put my foot down, and I told him, listen, if you're going to talk to me, you know, as a man, you know, respect me. And ever since the first day we met, I'm the only person that he doesn't scream at. We talk, we joke, and everybody hates it because even though I've been here for 10 years, I'm still technically the new guy. So I wanted to know your thoughts on assertiveness or not. I mean, monetarily, obviously, I'm not his equal, but just in me being or standing up for myself, he doesn't treat me the way he treats everybody else. What are your thoughts on that?
Jason, you should write the book because there are two things in your observation that are just nuggets of wisdom, which is, first of all, you know, scientists are finding that style of leadership of swearing at people and being uncivil, but which, by the way, tends 3 out of 4 times in organizations to come from people with power, is incivility. It diminishes innovation. It diminishes a worker's commitment to the job. It diminishes their well-being. It diminishes their creativity. It is a bad leadership style. Yeah. But the second thing, you know, and for 20 years I've been teaching people in organizations as part of my job at Berkeley, and a lot of people encounter the bullies and the Machiavellians and the impulsive leaders, and their consensus is exactly aligns with yours, which is what you have to do is you have to stand up to them. You have to look them in the eye and directly say, hey, you're swearing at me, right? You're yelling at me. I can't tolerate that, and make it on record. I'm going to tell you what's going on here. I'll tell other people, but that's not a rule of this organization or a way of civil exchange. And that is an empowering approach to the bullies and Machiavellians and impulsive leaders in the workplace that really works. So great job.
Well, let me ask you, Jason, while you're still on the phone, Professor, what if his coworkers, Jason's coworkers, were to all turn around and stand up to this bully? I mean, would it be too late because they've established these relationships where they're disempowered already?
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, the 20 years of wisdom that I've gleaned from the people I teach is That's an effective strategy, right? It's the best you can do with somebody who's abusing their powers. Collectively make it known to that individual that you're not going to stand for it. And if the person persists, the business usually suffers. And then people in the lower power positions have a choice of keeping that work and keeping that job or moving on, right? But it is one of the most effective strategies.
Oh, sorry, Kelton.
Yeah.
No.
One odd thing is that somebody else, I guess, after they saw, they had already been here for about 7 years, and they noticed the way our relationship, you know, mine and the CEO's was. They asserted themselves, but after being here for 7 years, and he fired them.
That's just it. That was the next thing.
Know.
Exactly. Oh, God. Well, Jason, good job.
You.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye.
You know, we have so much to cover. We need to cover how to avoid the power paradox trap. But before we do, I really want to talk about something Jason really kind of indirectly addresses, which is the price of powerlessness, which you spend a great deal of time on. And you write that powerlessness and the power paradox can't be separated. How a society does or does not respond to its most powerless people is often a direct measure of its vulnerability to the power paradox. So if you would just start, though, by telling your childhood story on, I forget, the K.O. Street, was it? Or when you moved
K.O.
to K.O.
Drive.
Street? K.O. Drive. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Bonnie. Well, you know, in 1970, my mom got a job as a professor, and we moved. She got her PhD at UCLA, and we lived in this middle-class, nice neighborhood in Los Angeles. And we moved to Northern California to a poor rural town in the poorest county in California, Placer County. And, you know, I was only 9. We moved to this town, and I was struck by how warm and kind the people were, how there's always a place at the dinner table, at open doors. But what I was also struck by, Bonnie, and I couldn't make sense of it at the time, was, you know, the of the 12 families on KO Drive, there were all kinds of health problems happening. You know, the dad at the top of the street clearly was suffering from massive depression. Across the street, a neighbor never came out, and I would learn that that's called agoraphobia, the paralyzing fear of going outside. My best friend Memo from Mexico, his sister had leukemia. His dad got cancer in his 60s and killed himself. You go down the street, a woman died in her 40s. And I was like, wow, you know, this is different than the other neighborhood I lived in. People are dying a little earlier. It's just quirky. And 20, 30 years later, we have started to understand what powerlessness does to the nervous system. And by powerlessness, I mean when you feel below other people because of your poor class or lack of wealth, or you are the victim of a sexist stereotype or a racist stereotype, all of those are forms of powerlessness or feeling less powerful than you could.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned is that state of not feeling like you can influence others, not having voice, feeling less powerful, activates the stress system in your body that shoots cortisol into your blood. And it basically basically starts to wear down the cells in your brain, your heart, your digestive system. The little tissues that are attached to your DNA called telomeres start to shorten and wither. The powerlessness caused by these various conditions shortens your life by 10, 15 years. Mm. And that's what I was seeing on my street and what I wanted to draw the reader's attention to who looks into the power paradox is, when we abuse our power, when we hoard resources, when we treat people in uncivilly, like Jason talked about at work, we're actually hurting their physical health.
Which is so important. And you talk about those findings, all the findings, and the stress response, the HPA axis, I mean, how cortisol is affecting people. So I guess where we should go, we need to take a short break before we go to how to avoid abusing power. We're speaking with Dr. Dacher Keltner, the author of The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. This short break, we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Dr. Dacher Keltner, an author and professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about his latest book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. And Professor, I think it's time to talk about how to handle power and avoid abusing it. How do we do that?
Well, you know, I have been struck by, you know, obviously we don't always abuse our power, right? There are leaders who don't act like Jason's boss. There are great presidents like Abraham Lincoln. And when we carefully study, you know, what those leaders do to really avoid the power paradox and the abuses of power that are so much a part of our daily life, they do certain things, right? So one is they really stay interested in other people. You know, I love this story of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's one of our great presidents, and really lifted up the welfare of people during the time of depression. And what he loved to do, and it drove his aides nuts, which is he had a special car that he could drive, that he would drive out into the small towns of the United States, often at physical peril, right? And go interact with the people. He stayed connected to the people he led. So one is to stay focused on the interests of others. You know, one thing that we also know that's really important is to cultivate a sort of an approach of respect and dignity, that we empower others, we value others, we dignify others through this ancient practice of respect, of speaking in considerate ways, of being kind. And then the third thing that I think is really important, and it's so interesting because a lot of the great leadership writers also talk about this, is to stay close to a sort of a commitment to service, to really think hard throughout your life, even if you have great power and lots of means, to think about serving people who aren't as fortunate as you, right? The United States, you know, when you take a step back and you think about our social conditions, we have a lot of powerlessness in our society. I think we're feeling that in the presidential election right now. We have people who are disenfranchised. We have 1 in 6 people who are at levels of poverty. We have 1 in 7 kids who are hungry chronically. So there is a lot of opportunities to use your power, to share, to focus in this attitude of service. These are old ideas, but they keep reappearing in the lives of people who use power for the good.
I'm just thinking how much self-awareness this presupposes, That's always, you know, a variable.
Yeah. What an important point, Bonnie. You know, and you know, one of the things that I write about in the end of The Power Paradox is, hey, we have to shift our thinking about power. Power is just part of your daily life. It's how you speak to your teenager. It's how you ask a favor of your romantic partner. It's what you do at work, right? It's just part of every interaction. And we are always vulnerable to abusing power through incivility or inappropriate or unethical behavior. And so self-awareness is really important. We know from neuroscience studies, once you're aware of your sense of power, or your sense of your emotion, the frontal lobes get engaged and they help you sort of not act inappropriately. They help you use your feelings for the better of others. So I think self-awareness is fundamental.
Let's just talk to Sam in Miami, who has a question for you. Sam?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This topic is very interesting. I just want to ask if there have been any studies about the police training and this whole notion of people who use inappropriate power. I see the same parallels with more officers, particularly who police different communities, in terms of how they enforce it. It tends to be people with high school diplomas or GEDs that make up the bulk of law enforcement. And I just want to know, do you see any correlation with that?
Professor?
Sure. You know, right now, this is a deep part of the conversation, both not only in the police and the criminal justice system, but also in the military, right, where there have been well-documented abuses of power, sexual violence, for example, in the military. And so there's this reconsideration right now in thinking about how we train our police officers to move away from more top-down, coercive, militarized models of community policing to more collaborative models of policing. They're really active, forward-thinking conversations right now, which I find very encouraging, that will move us out of this more strategically aggressive shakedown approach to policing to really officers of the peace within communities. Mm. So I think there are good conversations going on that align with what I write about in The Power Paradox.
Thanks so much, Sam, for calling.
Great question.
Listen, one question. How do I get a transcript of this discussion?
I'll let Richard Ives take back your call, and he'll let you know how you can do it. It's online. Actually, you just go to WLRN.org and Topical Currents. You can download a link to the program.
Okay. Great program. Great book.
Okay. Thank you. Professor, we have another caller, but I have to. This is just too cool. You were a consultant as a scientist for the Pixar film Inside Out. In fact, I even went on the IMDb website today and looked up Inside Out, and there you were under the thanks, and it said, Dacher Keltner, special thanks for guiding us through this emotional journey. That's really... So yeah. Just quickly, tell us what you did. First, the basic premise of the film and what you did on that film.
Yeah, so Inside Out, for those of you who didn't see it, was this really amazing movie last year from Pixar, directed by Pete Docter, about how a girl at 11 years old goes through a really complicated emotional time and guided by sadness and empathetic, empowering parents comes to a new state of development and a stronger early adolescent period in her life. And it is this journey of that sort of explores what the emotions are. What I got to do, Bonnie, was really incredible. I just would stop by at Pixar here in the East Bay of California and talk about the science of emotion, talk about how we express emotion, talk about emotion in the brains, talk about how parents can empower their kids by being open to their emotional changes and empathetic and kind, and just watch the story unfold into what I believe to be one of the most in kind of culturally shifting statements about what the human mind is and what our emotions are and what makes for really strong families is empathy and respect.
Mm-hmm. And you've worked with Facebook and Google.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, so these big new digital platforms that we've talked about that empower 1.6 billion people, Facebook, right, that share information in unprecedented ways, they bring in social scientists like myself to help out with things like, how do you get people to be a little bit more polite on the Facebook platform? How do you create a way in which couples can break up in a friendlier way? Or how do you curate somebody who's deceased on Facebook? So we've been helping out with a lot of the tricky social issues on that platform, sort of bringing the science that we've gathered into their design.
Well, thank you so much for all your work. We're really sorry we can't get to you, Paula, because we've run out of time. We've been speaking to, and Robin's email, Dr. Dacher Keltner is an author and professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the faculty director of both the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center and the Social Interaction Lab. He's a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion. And he's the author of other books, including Born to Be Good. His latest book that we've been discussing is The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. And websites or emails that you'd like to give?
Yeah, your listeners should go to greatergood.berkeley.edu. It is all free, and it is a place where they can learn about this new science of compassion and kindness and empathy and what it means for power. And it's all free and meant for people like your listeners.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I'm really glad we got to spend the hour with you.
It's been great talking with you, Bonnie. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And thank you so much for tuning in this hour. Our program was produced by lead producer Richard Ives. Technical direction is from our online producer, Paul Leary. And Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, we have free audio archives. I believe it was Sam who was asking of this and other programs for download at our website, WLRN.org. Just go to Radio Topical Currents and you'll find a link and can listen to the program again. More information also at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Join us tomorrow at 1 for a fascinating Topical Currents rebroadcast with chef and author Linda Gassenheimer. The topic is restaurant noise. We visit with representatives of the Earpiece Foundation and learn ways to protect our hearing and our digestion. Bonnie Berman, thanking my visitor in the studio today, my dear friend Karen Bender. It's been fun. Joseph Cooper, stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.